Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning. It is the 16th of April, and we are delighted to be in your company. It is a rainy Friday. It's chilly, and it is snowing, and I don't know. It's snowing where I was, and so meaning my home, and it may be snowing where you are. And or you may see snow on cars as you go by, as you travel around this morning, but it's out there. Otherwise, it's just wet and cold. But hopefully you can stay in, stay warm with the conversation that is forthcoming. Let me introduce everybody to you, and then we'll get started. I also want to remind you that you can always be a part of our program. You write to us at panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Here, ready and willing, able, I think, to move forward. I'm not happy about the snow situation. And I can say that there's nothing I can do about it.
Nothing you can do about it, but here we are. You know, we do what we can do. Also, we want to, good morning. Welcome to you. Siena College Economics Professor Aaron Pisidia is with us. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. It is not snowing anymore, but bossa nova is always a good antidote to April snow.
I agree. Absolutely. We try for it, you know, to have those antidotes. Senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator, Judith Enck. Judith, good morning. How are you?
Good. I'm happy to be your weather spotter in Rensselaer County. It is snowing quite a bit. And so that prompts me to wish everyone a happy early Earth Day, which is next Thursday, April 22nd, the 51st anniversary of Earth Day.
It is a major day, and we always thank you for being with us. And I know you have an upcoming event at Williams College, and I will talk about that later. Or I guess we could talk about it now, right? Might as well talk about it now. You're going to be giving a talk called Moving Beyond Plastics, the Environmental Justice, Climate Change, and Health Issue of Our Time. It's an online event, and it's going to be held on Earth Day, the 22nd, at 7 p.m. And you can go to williams.edu to find out more information. Am I correct on all of that, Judith?
Yeah, you are. I didn't know you knew about this. Thanks, Joe.
You are very welcome. Thank you. Last but certainly not least, our man here in Albany, Albany County District Attorney David Soares. Good morning. How are you?
Better now that you started off the morning with some Brazilian music. I thought I was in my own living room at my mom's house, but... Bon dia.
I all wish we were in our living room of our mom's house at this moment. It's very nice to have you here, David, as always. Thank you very much for being a part of the discussion. We welcome you again to be a part of the discussion panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'll go to letters in just a little bit, and we try to get to as many as possible. The big story this morning is, of course, 8 killed in a mass shooting at an Indianapolis FedEx facility overnight. Police say the gunman also wounded several others late Thursday before killing himself. The incident marks the 5th mass shooting in the United States in as many weeks. 8 killed, and again, many other injured, some critically. So this is another tragedy that has happened. Details are fairly scarce at this moment. This is a story that started to break around 2:30, 3 o'clock this morning Eastern Standard Time. We do know that we believe that the, I think we, when we say we do know, that the one of the dead is was the shooter. That has been said by police. Investigators are searching for a motive, and police said the shooting wasn't precipitated by any kind of a disturbance or an argument. And police responded just after 11 p.m. their time to report of shots fired. Upon arriving at the facility, officers came in contact with an active shooter. The gunman then apparently killed himself. 8 victims were pronounced dead at the scene, 5 people taken to hospitals, 2 others treated at the scene. And as I mentioned, 5th public mass shooting in the United States following massacres at three spas in Metro Atlanta, a supermarket in Boulder, Colorado, a Southern California office building, and a private residence in South Carolina. Despite the pandemic, 2020 was the deadliest year for U.S. gun violence in at least two decades. So, with that, we start. Alan?
He said it best when he said, when will we ever learn? It is extraordinary that we don't. And it is inevitable that we will. Somehow, some way, the American people will come to their senses. You know, there are a couple of things. First of all, do we really appreciate when we say, you know, eight people are dead? Do we know what that means? Do we all know what it means? Because when we do, there may be change. And when I say that, all anybody has to do is think of their own children, their own parents, their own relatives, the people that they love the most, their best friends, being senselessly slaughtered. That puts perspective when we talk about how many people, yeah, you know, are dying in each of these cases. So I'm thinking that we have to come to our senses. We will. It's just crazy. And then, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Alan. I'm sorry.
And then there's the question of who these people are. What it is that, so we simplify it and we say, well, more mental health. If we have more mental health professionals, this won't happen. I don't know. I think fewer guns. If you can get the guns away from people like this, you have a better chance of some kind of sanity returning to this country. And I mean, we have David Soares with us this morning, and he's got a, you know, and the police, all of whom have got to be very aware that this could happen virtually anywhere. And if you happen to be there, then you're in. So it's very, very scary.
It is. You know, your point, Alan, about that number and how, you know, do we internalize it? Do we understand it? Or is it just a number? And I know we've talked about this in regards to the number of COVID cases and the COVID deaths that we have seen. And even when journalists read lists like I did a moment ago about shootings where they will say this, 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 this. And in this case, where only four people were killed. And you know, it's that only. It's still four people, and it's a lot of people, and it is a mass shooting. David Soares.
You know, this is part of American life now. You know, so long as we continue to conflate people's Second Amendment rights and do nothing nationally to address this issue of people being able to obtain, you know, what I would consider to be weapons of local mass destruction without any kind of background checks. This is life in America. You know, I was thinking in hindsight over the comments that were made by the spokesperson for the police department after the massage parlor mass homicide a few weeks ago when he just, you know, kind of shrugged his shoulders and without, you know, an inch of empathy, said, you know, this defendant was having a bad day. Well, guess what? American citizens now, we are all subject to someone else's bad day. And until we get a handle on this, until we have bold leadership that's willing to take on, you know, the Republicans who were insistent upon having, you know, enough weapons to arm every man, woman, and child in this country, until you have bold leadership willing to take that on, and yes, I'm talking to you, Joe Manchin, right, then this is American life. And it doesn't matter whether you're in a massage parlor, a school, you know, a place of worship. This is what we can expect, never to be comfortable in our own public spaces.
Judith Henk.
Well, I think the important thing is not to just normalize this and accept this. As David said, it is part of our American life, and it's so tragic. It's these high-profile mass shootings, and then it's the day-to-day gun violence on so many city streets, not just cities, but all over the country. And, you know, it's astonishing that the NRA still has such an iron grip on the Congress that they won't do anything. I mean, this is the height of irresponsibility for the Congress. States can tighten their laws, and they should, but as we talked about last week, you can, if you're in New York, you can drive to Vermont and more easily secure a gun. It's just the sheer number, the millions of guns on the streets, and huge public support for tighter controls. There was a Quinnipiac poll yesterday. Across the board, the public wants stronger laws to get fewer guns on the streets, more background checks. And I think this really just comes down to the raw political power of the NRA and whether a majority of the members of Congress, or in the case of the Senate, more than a majority, are willing to stand up to gun manufacturers. This is not hunters saying they want to go deer hunting on the weekend. This is really raw political power and a lot of money involved. The NRA represents the gun makers, not just people who want to go hunting on the weekend. So I don't know what the tipping point is going to be. This is tragic, and we just can't allow ourselves to become numb to it. We really need to push Congress to act.
And Aaron Pasitti, your thoughts?
I think there's a second aspect to this. Obviously, it's the number of guns and the ease with which people can get guns. I think there's broader social forces at play. David mentioned people having a bad day. Well, for a lot of the population, they've been having a bad day for 40 plus years. They're subject to invisible forces that they can't control. There's a sense of increasing social isolation, a lack of meaning in work. I think people feel very disoriented in a world like this, and it's not new. And obviously, over the past 4 years, really since Trump was elected, and then particularly for the past year, that level of disorientation and lack of control is, just growing exponentially. And people get angry, and they seek control in whichever way they can get it. And one way that people can feel a sense of control, I believe, is by acquiring guns, whether or not they ever use them. But by acquiring them, that increases the supply and obviously makes it more likely that people will engage in, and I hate to say it, what is becoming a somewhat routine part of American life.
Well, it is routine. I mean, we've just talked about the number of incidents, and that isn't even, that doesn't even take account just the daily skirmishes and what we saw the other day in a Tennessee school and things that don't necessarily rise to quote unquote a mass shooting.
And Joe, nobody's even mentioned the Supreme Court of the United States, which may well be the final stop here in terms of the sanctions that Congress or anybody else could put on. It's just one more nail in the Supreme Court argument, to mix a couple of metaphors.
David Soares, for you as a district attorney in a large city in the state of New York, just put it in perspective. I mean, we're always waiting for a shoe to drop, I think, and seeing, we've had shootings at our local mall, and not to mention the shootings that regularly happen on our city streets. This is something that you deal with every single day, right?
It is something that we deal with. And by the way, I also happen to be in a building where right across the street is our civil courts, right? And our sheriff and our clerk. And this is where people who lawfully want to go about obtaining guns go about that process. And whenever there is, you know, the sort of violence that you're seeing like this, what it does is two things, right? It slows down the process by which people go about lawfully obtaining weapons, right? So that's terrible, right? And it creates sort of more political anxiety. But on the other hand, it seems that with the patchwork of just terrible legislation from state to state, it doesn't stop the flood of illegal guns on our streets. You would be horrified to see what police officers recover from crime scenes every day. At times when, you know, the person was actually carrying the weapon is almost smaller than the weapon that person is carrying. And it's terrifying. And, you know, the reality is that kind of violence tends to stay within certain communities. So it's not top of the mind awareness for people who are living in the comforts of peaceful communities in our suburban towns, right? Our neighbors. But this is a terrible problem. There was
David,
over 100.
Just hold on to that statistic of 100, and I'm going to take a break. And when we come back, I want you to continue your thought. I'm so sorry I had to interrupt it. We'll be right back. We have a BBC News break, and we'll return with David. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Shartok, Aaron Pasitti, Judith Enk, and we left off with David Soares, who was talking to us. I asked him a question right before the break about his office and dealing with the gun issue, which we're talking about in regards to what happened overnight at a FedEx facility. And David, you were starting off with a statistic. I had to break for news. Please continue.
Yeah, that's quite all right, Joe. No, what I was saying was the frustration of seeing over 125 people, okay, the vast majority of them, people of color, walking into emergency rooms in the Capitol District to remove bullets from their bodies, okay? Let me just say that one more time. Over 125 people. And this year we're on pace to beat that number. And the warm weather hasn't even gotten here yet, okay? Now, if you were to say that in any other community, this would just be unacceptable, and people would be paying more attention, and we would be engaging in more deliberative processes in order to remove these guns from communities. We had four children that were shot in our community. The three-year-old sleeping in her bed at a daycare facility. Right, 10-year-old who's literally sitting on his bed, ready to go to bed with an iPad, shot through a window, and the 7-year-old who did nothing but, you know, walk around the city of Albany with his dad holding his hands, shot. This is just unacceptable, you know. And the reality is, for me, look, I get it. When it happens and the numbers are high, that's what the media tends to focus on. Oh, you know, 7 bodies, 8 bodies. Man, you got hundreds and hundreds of bodies that are being shot and destroyed by you know, weapons of mass destruction on the streets of our cities in this country. And again, it's going to require bold leadership. Alan mentioned, a Supreme Court. You know, our courts have done a great job so far in interpreting, you know, the Second Amendment. People v. Heller certainly is a seminal case. You know, you have a right to bear arms. That is a fundamental right as a result of Heller. You just don't have the right to have tanks, to have shoulder missile launchers, okay? And I think that assault weapons fall in that category. And so gun violence isn't just about shooters and people who are the recipient of those bullets. There's also a whole host of other, you know, collateral issues that result. For example, you know, when there's gunplay in communities, you know, the police tend to come into those communities under a much more militarized, you know, sense, right? Because it's gun violence. And so the opportunities for, you know, civilians and law enforcement to engage in exchange of gunfire increases when you have things like that are happening in community. So, you know, we've got to take a deep breath, stop with, well, our thoughts and prayers, you know, the typical responses that you see when these events take place. And And we have to come to the table, and we have to establish some semblance of order in our country, not just in the state of New York, not just in Albany County, but in the United States of America.
Well said, David. Again, we're talking about this shooting that happened overnight in the city of Indianapolis. And it is at a FedEx facility, 8 people killed in that mass shooting. Alan, anything else you'd like to add to what David was just saying? All right. How about you, Judith?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to make this even more disturbing and depressing. I doubt Indiana is going to tighten state gun control laws after this high-profile incident. And you think of families living in communities and kind of the anxiety that parents feel when their kids are out driving or walking or living their lives and you count on the police to protect you. And we need a responsible police force to protect against gun violence. But, you know, I think we also need to focus on gun violence by police. I mean, the case of Adam Toledo, a 13-year-old boy shot last month. You know, we had not heard about that story, but this nationally, but this happened a number of weeks ago, and the police pushed out a narrative that he had a gun and they were in pursuit of him. It seems like he didn't have a gun, and this kid was in seventh grade. You know, maybe he wasn't an angel, but he doesn't have to be an angel in order not to be shot on the street. And of course, Dante Wright, age 21, with the police officer confusing the taser gun with the regular gun, if in case that proves to be true. She, of course, has been charged now. But, I mean, the gun issue is so pervasive. And I'm not arguing that the police should not have guns. I am arguing that the police also have a role to play in terms of really avoiding gun violence, so we just don't have, you know, thoughts and prayers playing on a loop.
Aaron, I think Alan is not with us, so we're having some technical difficulties, so we'll get Alan back on and we'll go to him in a moment. Aaron, any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm just picking up on what David and Judith said, and I want to really politely disagree with Alan talking about when he mentioned that we will learn from this. I really don't think we will. This is a long-term trend that is just getting worse. Started with the anti-Clinton vitriol in the 90s, and then the whole questionable weapons of mass destruction and invasion of Iraq, and then you have the Tea Party, and now you have QAnon, and on top of this you have rising gun violence. You know, it's been 20 plus years of a society that's kind of going off the rails, whether it's just the volume of individual shootings, whether it's the volume of mass shootings, whether it's the volume of police shootings. If we haven't learned already, I have a tough time seeing in any reasonable way that we will learn. You have very entrenched vested interests that are preventing this, not only with the NRA, but politicians that are just whose entire career is based on creating fear and panic among their voters. So I have a little bit of a more depressing and darker view of where we're heading as a society. And to the extent that we can turn it around, that's going to take decades. And then we're probably not going to see the fruits of that decision for decades. So I am not optimistic about this.
Alan, you are back.
Hi.
Your thoughts.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Can you hear me? Yeah, sorry, I'm using an alternative device today, and I'm not really familiar with it. I'm not good at it. I think Aaron is right. It's very depressing. You know, we want increased background checks But we don't really know that the people who could be backgrounded would be found to be deficient. In many cases, they are not. So it's a sociological problem, of course, because the society has a lot of very, as Aaron says, a lot of very disturbed or angry people in it. But I think what happens, and I'm more optimistic than he is, that when people decide commonly that they've had enough, that they press their politicians, that they get so angry that even the Supreme Court and the people on it have to listen and say, oh, this could undermine our efficacy here, or whether people will listen to us. So yeah, Aaron may be right. I hope he's wrong. But I hope that we understand that so many of these people are just really mentally deficient. And that is as big a problem as anything else.
I want to take a break.
I think bottom for this country was Newtown.
Yeah.
When you lose children, that's bottom. And if we haven't come back from bottom, we ain't ever coming back.
We'll pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we have many letters on this. We'll go to those, and then we'll move on to other stories. Great panel this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Ank, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. We will talk about this and other stuff and include your letters. Panel at WAMC.org right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Ank, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. So we have letters. Let's go to them. Michael says, I hate to say the same thing again, but it is still the glaring truth. Get the private money out of the campaign process. This frees the representatives to do what the American people already want them to do, which is reasonable gun control. There are a host of other laws that the American people want, but that our legislators can't provide because they are beholden to the moneyed class. Campaign finance, campaign finance, campaign finance, ... exclamation point, says Mike. Judith, did you want to add to that?
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, it's on guns, it's on climate point. Change, it's on, you know, it's on access to health care. I mean, I think we should just drop everything and work on campaign finance reform, because we're just going to be nibbling around the edges on so many issues until we get big money out of government decision making.
And we still have that court. I was going to use an adjective, but I'm going to stay with court, Judith, which comes up with Citizens United, in order to protect the very things that our excellent letter writers and you are telling us.
It's a big problem.
Let's see. We go to, I agree with the panelist. I don't know which one of you, but we'll suss that out in a moment. As long as there are fragile male egos puffed up by white privilege, we will have killings because they are armed, ignorant, and scared. That from Bob. Aaron is right, says Lynn. It's been 20 years of this building and people don't seem to get it. For instance, in my town, is that a Democrat just had to release a newsletter to state that they had to coerce an owner of an Arlington near Vassar College, that's the area near Vassar College, business owner to remove Nazi symbols from their business window. Dutchess County, New York, just an hour and 20 minutes north of one of the most diverse cities in the entire globe. What is happening? We are going back with people, I'm not sure what it would, or we're going backwards, and I'm not sure what it would take to change things, honestly. Maybe the next generation, although this generation has its share of QAnon, and let's face it, most kids become brainwashed by the way they are raised. This letter has a lot of, it has no grammar, so that's why I'm struggling. I apologize. I mean, it has no punctuation, is what I meant. No punctuation. So I'm doing my best. But I think that's the point. Lynn, thank you for your letter. And why we ask you to pre-read them, I'm not calling you out. I'm just saying, using it as an example. Anyone want to comment on that?
Yes. Am I the optimist in this group? Because I think things are getting worse and worse. I agree with everybody. On the other hand, I think when you hit the lowest point, people start to do what, and we're Americans, that they have to do in order to preserve what we have. And I think, you know, unlike, I have great respect for Adam, believe me, I do. I think we just can't wash our hands of it and say, oh, this is the way it's going to be. I think we all have to work on it, and we all have to hope it does change.
David?
I agree with you, Alan, but, you know, for the writer of that letter, okay, look, I understand that for some people, they may believe that we have come such a long way. And I guess if what your comparison is to 1619, I guess we have come a long way. And I guess if your comparison is, you know, the 1950s and 1960s, yeah, I guess we're sitting, you know, in the same booths and not at separate lunch counters. But make no mistake about it. Like, our country is seriously flawed when it comes to race and racial dynamics. And I think you just had, you know, a president who just made it okay for people to sort of wave that flag. It's not shocking to me that you have, in the county right next door, there are Confederate flags that flow, you know, about when I'm traveling through them. And I'm, you know, certainly happy that my car's not breaking down near one of those homes. But, you know, the reality is that we've made some progress, but we're not there yet. And you shouldn't fall for sort of the false, you know, the first African-American president.
Who's that being arrested? Who on the panel is kidding?
I just sent
the police over to Aaron's house to pick up his banjo.
All right. I just, if you, anyone, if it's not David and you need a lawyer, we have one on the phone. So go ahead. Go ahead, David. I'm sorry.
No, it's just, I think that people are operating under a false sense of security and to some degree, some illusions because, you know, again, we're not dining in separate lunch counters, but we still have a fundamental problem of racism in this country. And the fact that you're seeing, you know, symbols posted on windows and such, some people are shocked by it. But if you're a person of color negotiating their way through, you know, our cities and our communities on a daily basis, it just means that it's Friday morning and the weather's bad. It's just another day. So we shouldn't allow for the achievements and some of the greater symbolic things to cloud the fact that we still are a nation of problems. But I believe, like Alan said, I'm optimistic that things are going to get better over time.
Kathleen writes to us and says, the reality is that women are as likely or statistically maybe even more likely to have mental health issues and mental illnesses, but they do not take out a gun and shoot people. This is an issue of toxic masculinity. Interesting perspective. We go to Kathy, who writes, what strikes me about all of these events is that in each one, the police start the event with intensive escalation, screaming repeated orders, get out of the car, get out of the car, get out of the car, all for an air freshener or proper tags, whatever. These are the militaristic tactics I see on the news when the Marines are entering enemy quarters or the police are going after a mass murderer. What the heck? It's no wonder the brain gets confused. The people are elevating these situations before they even begin, creating tension and hysteria. Is this about militaristic training combined with various levels of racism? How do we deprogram the police? Oh my God, it's just so, with a lot of O's, horrific.
Excellent point. You know, I'm a white woman. And if I were to have an air freshener, what we're referencing is when Dante Wright was pulled over, one of the first things he said to his mom, who was on the cell phone when he was pulled over, he thought he was being pulled over because of an air freshener dangling from his rearview mirror. And Chris Churchill with the Times Union actually had a really good column on this yesterday about air fresheners, in fact, you shouldn't have them dangling from your rearview mirror, and you're not supposed to have stickers on the back window of your car, which means we have massive violation of the vehicle and traffic law throughout our region. If I were pulled over because I had an air freshener in my car, I think the police, I can say with great confidence, would treat me quite differently than they treated a 20-year-old African-American male. And of course, you know, the police will say, well, there are other issues why we pulled him over. But that was the thing that prompted it. So we don't have anything close to equity in terms of how laws are enforced, even the vehicle and traffic law.
Let's see. We have 5 minutes or so before we have to go to a break, and we have a ton of letters, so I want to get to as many as possible. Ginny writes, I hate to sound so jaded, but if the country didn't do anything about guns after Sandy Hook, we are almost beyond redemption. I, too, says Susan, have little faith that the nation will come out of the gun fever. However, our children, I have none personally, but they are all our children, must know we did not give up. Maybe, just maybe, one day, long hence, sanity will prevail. John from Pownall says, anyone that buys a gun is playing into the hands of the NRA and gun manufacturers, blowing smoke. There is no reason for civilians to own guns. That does not contribute to the violence in America. I get the point. Lori says, while I agree that gun violence is a huge problem in our country that needs solutions, the panelists have not been accurate in their descriptions of the violence. The officer that said the guy was having a bad day was stating the words of the suspect. Well, right. Exactly. We all have bad days. We don't shoot people. But okay. And in the incident, I apologize for the commentary. And in the Chicago incident, the suspect was found with a gun nearby and had residue on his hands. All incidents are not the same. Well, that is true, right, David?
Yeah, that's. I think a lot of that is the media as well. And you got to be more responsible in the reporting. You know, the things that transpire in, you know, whether it's in Oregon, whether it's in Washington State, you know, it's a situation that's occurring there. And I think we get into the habit of painting everyone with the same broad brush. We have problems in policing and in the criminal justice system, to be sure, just like we have problems in every system, that whether it's the medical field or what have you. But these quick off-the-cuff solutions, that's not the answer. You know, the reality is that we need policing. The question then becomes, what kind of quality of policing are we willing to invest in? Because I think if what you do is you maintain the status quo, then what you're going to see is the result you're going to get is the result we have now. It's inconsistent from town to town, from state to state. But if we take on this issue and we're serious about it, hey, let's try to attract the best, you know, candidates for it, as opposed to a 23andMe, you know, resume that says I'm related to, you know, someone in the upper ranks of a police department, and therefore I'm qualified to get a job. But that's the hard look that we have to do, not the quick, easy solutions that seem to be coming down from state capitals everywhere across the country.
Although, David, I want to ask you, I think as a society, we've kind of, curious to your response, I think we've moved on from there are a few bad apples in the police force. You know, Derek Chauvin is an outlier. That's not how most police would have handled that situation, which I actually think is true. But I think, you know, the notion of looking at how policing happens, you just mentioned looking at how recruitment happens. I mean, there are some profound problems with policing in the United States that is, you can't just dismiss these high profile tragedies as a few bad apples. And perhaps it's inadequate.
I don't think,
but
right? That's not at all what I'm saying about a few bad apples. That's not at all what I'm saying.
No,
what,
I know
what
that.
What I'm saying is in the 20 years of my practice, okay, what I have seen is a shrinking footprint of both mental health, right, in communities. Mm-hmm. That footprint continues to shrink, and we see a growing footprint in enforcement, right? And so I can readily tell you that the police aren't qualified to deal with a lot of the issues that communities present them with, right? Like the criminal justice system. That's not what we do, right? But and so when you have a system that is designed to do vehicular, you know, and traffic enforcement, to intercede in violent conduct, when in addition to that, you're now putting all of this other stuff onto them, right? This is likely what you're going to have. I don't mean to say that Chauvin and a lot of these incidents, quite honestly, like all of these things being filmed now is validation for what many people have been complaining about in law enforcement, you know, throughout the course of time. It's now coming to the surface and people are seeing it, but we've always known about it. But the question then becomes, what do we do about it? Well, we can react and say, okay, let's go repeal 50A. All right, repeal 50A. But what is repealing 50A doing to change, you know, the culture of recruitment, of requiring more from people that want to be police officers?
What's 50A?
Yeah, thank you, Judith, because I didn't know.
50A, right, Jake, is that part of the law that says you can't release
information? 50A is a civil rights that protects the disciplinary records and other personnel records of law enforcement, which is what has been repealed in New York State and many other states to allow for people to have access now to disciplinary records, which are good first steps. We need to go more, take a deeper dive, because this is something that we fundamentally need in our society. We need policing in our society. So the question is, do we want 21st century policing, 22nd century policing, or do we want what we've grown up with? I think what we want is something better that requires a greater investment. And you know, it's like if you're going to invest in this profession, then you lure the best qualified candidates. And I think you see that in glimpses now. But we do need change. I don't disagree with that.
We are very late for break, so we must go to that. And when we come back, I'll go to more letters. We have, as I said, we have a ton of letters. I thank you very much for writing in. We'll try to get to as many as we can when we come back. We won't be able to get to all of them, but we'll get to a few and hit some key points, and then we'll move on to some other subjects in our time remaining. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasidi, and David Soares, we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. First, this break and news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasidi, and David Soares. As I mentioned, we have a lot of letters on this topic. I want to get to some of the key points, and then we will move on to other subjects in our remaining time on this Friday morning broadcast. So we go to, and I do have to say, we really do have a ton of, of letters on this, and they're all like really good points. But I can't get to all of them, so I will try as best we can to get to the key ones. Let's see. Nance says, couldn't the police just send tickets in the mail for traffic violations like a burned-out headlight, a hanging air freshener, an expired registration, no turn signal, etc.? The police needs to avoid the police could avoid these confrontations. Then Peter writes, Americans have not yet come to terms with the reality that democracy does not give you a right to do whatever you want whenever you want to do it. Owning an arsenal, not wearing a mask, etc. This selfish predisposition was intensified by Trump and continues to be advocated by the extreme right. Don't expect sensible gun laws to be legislated until we as a nation begin to understand the responsibility we as citizens of a democracy all share for protecting and supporting one another. The gun issue is just one manifestation, thank you, of the breakdown of the democratic values in this country. This one is for you, David. It is from Thomas, who says, what about all the people who drive around with their handicap parking permit hanging from their mirror? I'm sorry. That is not for David. This one's for David. Can David tell me why, if there is a warrant out for an arrest, and the gentleman has been stopped, but then takes off speeding away. Why the police can't go pick him up later, why it has to be a deadly shootout right there, I just don't understand that. It's a great letter.
Well, the writer is absolutely correct. And, you know, right now the best practices tell you that, first of all, if it's a pursuit, don't chase, because in that chase, in that effort to apprehend that one individual, you may cause greater collateral damage. And so you have your dash cameras on, you have the plates, you can find the car later, okay? So a lot of departments are using tactics like that, which is why I find it so hard to understand how it is that we have the incident that took place in, I believe it was Virginia, where there was a tag on the car and you know, we're removing the Marine at gunpoint. And then specifically this issue, it's a matter of escalation. The officers, you know, approach this issue in such an escalated state of mind that there was no one on site to engage in that kind of de-escalation that would have brought some remedy to the issue. And instead, what we have is the death of a young man.
And in the case of Dante Wright, I mean, the police officer who shot him was, I think she had like over 20 years right. on the force, and I think was the president of the union. And I want to circle back to my back and forth with David. David, I was not suggesting that you were saying a few bad apples. My point was, the thing that makes me a little bit hopeful is I think the national narrative has moved on from a few bad apples, and there seems to be much more interest in looking at the systemic problems with the way policing happens in the United States, such as I thought the letter writer was really useful in pointing out, if someone is out on a warrant, you know, you don't
get them
have
later.
To have a
right.
Yeah, you don't have to shoot them, even with a taser, if that's the offense.
You know, I keep coming back to my little town of Great Barrington, population 7,000, and in the teens on the police officer's side. What a difference we have now. We had a different department. I'm not going to go into that years ago. But now we have a department that is doing this incredible outreach, pleasant, nice to everybody, not authoritarian. So, and under the leadership of, you know, of a brilliant town manager who is in charge, as opposed to the chief being in charge, clearly the town manager has something to say about the way it's going. So it is possible, my point being, if it's possible in 7,000 people with Great Barrington, it certainly is possible everywhere else.
Let's go to...
That is true.
Go ahead.
No, I was just saying that is true. You have people that come in a position of leadership that have influence throughout the entire culture. And I agree with you, Judith, that this is exactly what we need. We need to be moving in a more professionalized direction. And again, we have to talk about certain things like compensation that will attract the best qualified people to these positions.
William has a question, and I'm wondering, so I don't know if his thesis is correct. So I start with that as a question, and then I'll read what he has to say. The safest places in the country have the least gun control. In contrast to cities like Chicago, Philadelphia, Detroit, etc., with the strictest gun control laws, are the least safest. These facts are ignored by those advocating for more gun control. Legal gun owners aren't the problem. Would the panel be in favor of a federal mandatory minimum of 5 years for anyone caught with an illegal gun? That's a law that would actually have an impact on the source of most gun crime. I don't know, and am not able to quickly check on the
I don't think the first part of that question.
Yes.
I don't think the first part of that question is accurate, because after New York adopted the SAFE Act, incidents went down significantly. I think the data is states with stronger controls on gun purchase and gun use see less incidents. Right, David?
Yeah. The premise of the question. First of all, there is no monitor. There's no one maintaining tabs on the illegal guns that enter into our community. The only time that we can ever track those kind of statistics is actually when we have one of those illegal guns in our possessions, and then we can, through NIBIN and other tools that we use to trace the origin and where those weapons, you know, originate from, that's the only way that we know. But we have at no point in time a count on how many guns are in a community. So I think cities like Chicago, cities, you know, in New York City, Albany for that matter, you know, it's not the legal guns that are involved in a lot of the incidents that we're talking about. It's the illegal guns. And so this whole premise about gun control, you know, and I just disagree with it because it's not based in scientific fact. It's an anecdotal comment that's being made for the purposes of attracting someone to the discussion. I don't really have much to offer there.
All right, we're going to move on to other topics. If we stayed on this and I just read letters, we could fill the rest of the show. But I do want to get to what other stories and talk about other things on this Friday morning. Let's go to the jobless numbers. Aaron, you're up. We talk about where we are this morning, and I'll let you release the news on the weekly unemployment claims and where we are.
Can you put on the Bossa Nova music while he does it?
Yeah, sure. We can cue the Bossa Nova economy music.
Thank you, David. I'm still in search of a theme song. So if anybody has any ideas that are radio friendly, please let me know. So what I'm about to say is I just really think pales in comparison. So the discussion we just had is a really tough act to follow, but. What we've seen over the past couple months is what appears to be some sustained early recovery data. A lot of major economic indicators for the past 3 months have gone in the right direction. Unemployment's down and trending down. GDP is likely to increase. Both the manufacturing and the service sector are seeing increased activities. Jobless claims, weekly jobless claims, are down to their lowest level since the pandemic started. That's still double the normal historical level, even in the worst of times. But we're not in normal historical times, so that has to be read as good news. Retail sales. Meaning people spending at stores, restaurants, and online are up almost 10% this month. So a lot of indicators have been pointing in the right direction for the past 3 months. So you're starting to see some green shoots of recovery. People are being hired back. Incomes are starting to creep up. People are spending more. These are all the drivers of recoveries. And like I've said before, this is largely due to finally a coherent relief plan from President Biden, who passed measures to help households weather very difficult financial times. I think more than that, though, is the increased pace of vaccinations. In tandem, those have increased consumer and business confidence and is leading to some behavioral changes. So this is good. This is what we expect to see, but like I said, it's the first green shoots. It's not we are far from being out of the woods and on a stable path to recovery.
So, in order of preference, and I guess I'm just interested in the top one, what are we most worried about, or what should we be most worried about?
The speed and strength of the recovery will be entirely dictated by the spread of COVID. So, what we need to be worried about are people taking it easy and taking their foot or not being as cautious and not following CDC or public health guidelines, because if people see this and they see, infection rates coming down and they start engaging in behavior without masks, not social distancing, all of those economic gains that were really, really hard earned over the past 3 months can be reversed in the span of a couple weeks. So it's really important that people maintain their vigilance by wearing masks, by social distancing, following CDC and public health guidelines to ensure that this recovery has an opportunity to take root and to ensure that we get out of this as fast as possible.
Anyone else want to weigh in on that?
You know, I know this is going to seem a little bit, you know, muddy, but part of this is that there's a decision on the part of a lot of people. I'm going to behave differently here, as Aaron has just indicated. I may not wear a mask, but more so, I'm going back to work. I'm going to eat in restaurants. I'm going to travel a little bit. And I understand about the COVID, but that the American people are taking a different view as to what you should do. The governor of New York, for example, has said in the past, he didn't always practice it himself, but has said in the past, stay home. Don't go out. Don't leave. And so what is happening now is we're saying, all right, let's do this a little bit differently. And I think, Aaron, that's what's going on. It's helping in the recovery. Because if somebody's keeping their business open, their restaurant open, it's going to work, that's a whole different thing than we were having before. And it's all attitudinal.
Aaron?
Absolutely. We lost a really important opportunity when this started to provide as much relief to households and businesses as necessary so that they wouldn't be forced into a position of, well, I need to go to work and I know it's risky, but I also need a paycheck versus I'm going to stay at home. So you have people's individual economic interests in direct conflict with, the collective social and public health interests. So that cat's out of the bag. So, I think the only thing we can hope for is that, people at least moderate some of their riskier behavior and that we keep on jabbing people in the arm at a solid pace.
All right. Anyone else?
Yeah, well, anyone else I already spoke, but let me just say that what Aaron just said, is so interesting considering that Pfizer, as of this morning, is now saying you're going to have to get booster shots.
Right.
So this is going to go on for a long time. I think it's something that's worth mentioning because it's going to be a game changer in many ways. People are going to have to be doing it differently now.
All right. Let's move on to other stuff here. And we go to, I believe we go to Judith now to talk about the U.S. and China. And we talked a little bit about this last week, but the start of this, but obviously much more has happened. John Kerry, President Biden's climate envoy, is pressing China to do more to address global warming, but he faces an emboldened Beijing and leadership that thinks the United States has lagged behind. So, not an untrue thought, right, Judith?
No, I mean, unfortunately, it's a valid criticism, especially during the Trump years. And so you have China kind of throwing that back at us, saying the United States has neither the moral standing nor the real power to issue orders to China on climate issues. And I think that's right. We do not have either of those things because of the 4 years of Trump. They probably just need to say that, and now let's compartmentalize and move on. These conversations between John Kerry and Chinese leaders are so crucially important. China emits more greenhouse gas emissions than any other country, 28%, followed by the United States, which emits 14% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. So President Biden is doing a virtual climate summit with dozens of different countries. He's doing this on Earth Day, yay. And China has not yet accepted the invitation to the conversation. So what John Kerry is doing is, one-on-one diplomacy. He was in India, he's now in China. Trying to bring people around. This is happening at a pretty rapid pace for American diplomacy. We all need John Kerry to succeed. And at the same time, we really should absorb the criticism of the Chinese government. And it's not just Trump. I'll point out in New York State, where New York has ambitious greenhouse gas reduction goals, there's a proposal now near Ithaca, New York, and another one in North Tonawanda, New York, to build, to use Bitcoin mining, which is a huge, huge energy consumer. And yet the state of New York has chosen not to require any real environmental review on these Bitcoin operations.
All right.
And so there's a lot we need to do.
What is Bitcoin mining?
Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask me that. So Bitcoin mining is...
I know what Bitcoin is. I know what mining is. I don't know how they match.
Well, it's basically all the computers that keep cryptocurrency going. There's a great piece in the New York Times earlier this week that one Bitcoin mining operation could use the same amount of energy as an entire country. So it's very, you know, Bitcoin is not a recognized currency, but people are using it, and it is enormously energy intensive. So what's happening near Ithaca, there is a power plant called Greenwich. It was shut down for 7 years. Restarted using fracked gas. And New York State government says because it's, quote, behind the meter, they can't regulate it. So it's going to cancel out, you know, hard-fought gains on climate reduction. Across upstate New York, we now have two of these proposed facilities. And so, you know, something like that will come up in China discussions.
One of my favorite movies that happened in Ithaca. Anyone else on that? Hearing none, we move on. We just have about a minute and a half before we have to go over to a break. So I will go to a letter to people still writing about our earlier conversation. Every time I hear a discussion about gun control in society, I immediately think of a song from South Pacific entitled "You Can't." You've got to be careful taught, in which is discussed racial profiling and bigotry as taught by a person's family. Also, question for David, why is there a warrant out for person? Oh, I already asked that, didn't I? My apologies. And imagine the scene of Mr. Floyd's murder in the Chauvin trial if no witnesses or cameras were present. There would probably be no trial now. Yes. And panel, and the piling on continues. Enough. There are over 700,000 law enforcement officers in the country. Yes, recruiting is a problem, especially post 9/11. And yes, one tragic event is too many, but the generalizations regarding police are not worthy of open-minded liberals. As a retired police officer, I do not support in any way renegade cops, but stop insinuating that they are not renegades. Thank you, David, for your well-rounded perspective. That from John. We'll pause there. When we come back, we'll move on to other subjects. We welcome your input, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we'll have last call with our terrific group of panelists this morning, Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pacitti, and David Soares. And again, we welcome your letters. We just ask for them to be short, to the point, have grammar, punctuation, all that stuff. Makes it easier. And I thank you. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. About 10 minutes left with our group this morning, and we welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. I want to talk about the Derek Chauvin trial. We've been talking about incidents similar incidents, and of course the Dante Wright shooting earlier this week. But the defense has rested after Derek Chauvin declined to testify in his murder trial and the death of George Floyd. He invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. It was a lot going on yesterday, a very dramatic day in the courtroom. Derek Chauvin spoke publicly for the first time since his arrest in May, telling a judge Thursday he would invoke his constitutional right against self-incrimination and not testify in his own defense in his murder trial and the death of George Floyd. The defense rested its case minutes later after just 2 days of testimony, paving the way for closing arguments and jury deliberations in the landmark trial to begin on Monday. In a dramatic moment outside the view of the jury, the former police officer removed his face mask inside the downtown Minneapolis courtroom where he has sat silently and stoically day after day through jury selection and weeks of intense testimony about the night Floyd died while pinned beneath his knee.
So David Chassors, I wonder if you would explain a little bit about the First Amendment, the Fifth Amendment. It looks bad. I mean, if you say, I want to protect myself against self-incrimination, then a jury hears that. And the jury during the voir dire said, we want to hear directly from him. Maybe you could do some kind of praise on that.
Yeah, well, so I think what Mr. Chauvin did was what he should have done. He certainly didn't want to take that stand and subject himself to cross-examination from the people. So judges do a very good job of reminding the jury, right, that a defendant has no obligation at all to put forth any evidence. A defendant certainly enjoys the right of that presumption of innocence, and they carry with them that presumption throughout the proceeding. But the judge was very careful yesterday, because one of the things that happens, you know, if you miss it at a trial, there are certain things that can, in fact, be used on appeal. So if the judge had just listened to the defense attorney, and the defense attorney was the one that said, oh, he's not going to take the stand, that's a basis for someone to come along down the road and try to file an appeal, assuming that there's a conviction here of Mr. Chauvin. So the judge was very good in making sure that he got that answer directly from Chauvin, that he just didn't rest with one question. He dug in a little deeper, informing him of all of his rights. So that's the kind of thing that, yes, I understand that juries want to hear from a defendant, but a defendant has absolutely zero obligations, and most judges are very, very good about reminding a jury that the failure of a defendant to come forward and testify should not, under any circumstances, be used against that defendant in a trial. So they do a good job of that.
Does it work?
That's a great question, Joe.
You know, so here we are, a nation of laws, hundreds of years, and what works and what doesn't work, I can tell you this, that those prosecutors in that case did a fantastic job. They did a fantastic job of presenting this case, but I can tell you that the first people in the room that have butterflies in their stomach and that are uncertain as to the outcome, it's those prosecutors, and they're the people that were the closest to this case. But there's a part of me understanding that the subject matter here is just horrible, right? I mean, we're talking about the death of an individual at the hands of law enforcement that was witnessed by millions and millions of people. And so that is terrible. But we still have a system of justice here that works. And I think that those cameras in that courtroom over the course of the last several weeks have demonstrated just how amazing a system that we have by showcasing all of those aspects. Now, the hard part, of course, will come today, because jury voir dire is one of the most important aspects of a trial. And so those prosecutors had to make sure, as did the defense attorney, that there were no biases. And, you know, the voir dire is an important part in selecting that jury. The second most important part occurs this morning, which is the instructions that are going to be sent back with the jury as they deliberate. And there were a number of really significant things that occurred yesterday during that discussion, which occurred outside the presence of the jury.
Judith?
Oh, I just think this has been a fascinating trial. It's pulled the curtain back on how the system works, and I'm, you know, it's so compelling, but I'm not sure, you know, what the final outcome is going to be, because we've been down this road before. You know, it
from the outside, it sure looks quite compelling that Chauvin broke the law and should be held accountable. But you just never know.
So the question for you, Judith, would be, having seen it and having an open trial where television cameras were on and we saw what was happening, what do you think about doing that in New York State?
Yeah, I personally support cameras in the courtroom. I know a lot of defense attorneys are opposed because they're concerned that things would be sensationalized, but the jury is seeing this anyway. I mean, I think more transparency, the better.
Aaron?
I would agree with that. I think the only concerns that I would ever have is, of course, you don't want the identity of a witness, of certain witnesses, to ever be published. And certainly jurors come in and do their job, but I don't think they're looking for any fanfare. And so as long as you don't have jurors and their identities being put out, I think cameras in the courtroom add to the transparency and it adds to the restoration of confidence in our system.
Aaron Pacitti.
Yeah, absolutely. Just, you know, providing people exposure to this is important so that they don't feel that, you know, there's something happening behind closed doors. But I want to pick up on something Judith said about, you know, her, for lack of a better term, speculation about what the outcome is going to be. You know, I think there's an interesting parallel here between our earlier discussion regarding gun violence and now police misconduct. And that is, you know, we're a society that's faced with compelling evidence about things that work and can be tolerated and things that don't work and shouldn't be tolerated. And I think, sadly, this trial fits into the we've been down this road before, and we know how the story ends. So I am not really optimistic that, in my opinion, that justice will prevail.
I think, look, so I would.
Aaron isn't optimistic about anything today. Go ahead.
Well, he didn't have his Bustin' Oven music when he did the jobs report, and I think that would have changed his perspective. But
we have a little Eeyore with us today.
Cases, you look at these case by case. I know it's easy to lump them together because what you have are common patterns of police behavior and the resulting death. But they're all different. I've never seen a case with these facts where you have the police chief of the department testifying on behalf of the people against, you know, the officer. I've never witnessed the trainers of the officer take the stand and testify against the officer. I've never actually seen a case where, gee, the people that happened to be out and about that day happened to be an off-duty fireman who witnessed it and came in and testified. There were just so many interesting issues that took place in the fact pattern of this case that doesn't exist anywhere. And so, yes, I mean, the reality is prosecutors have to convince unanimously. They have to convince, you know, 12 people. And the defense has to throw a monkey wrench in there and persuade one person not to go along with the other 11. I get that. But I believe that we're going to see a good outcome here. He's definitely he's faced with murder in the second, murder in the third, and manslaughter. So the jury is going to have their options as to where they go with this. But I do believe that based on the strength of the evidence, the character, the characters that testify, the overwhelming emotional testimony that took place at the very beginning of this case, I think all of those things there'll be a confluence of all of those events that will convince these 12 people to make the appropriate decision here, which is, you know, guilty on murder in the second degree.
Well, we are.
And remember, this is.
Go ahead, Judith. Less than a minute, but go ahead.
Yeah, this was kind of the gold standard of a trial. It was handed off to Attorney General Keith Ellison to prosecute, if I'm correct. And it seemed to come pretty quickly, less than a year after the crime. So, you know, it could be it could be a standard for other situations like this, which we want to see less of.
With that, we will end this morning. My thanks to everybody for being with us. I hope you have a beautiful weekend. Alan, thank you very much, as always. Judith, Alan, are you still there?
No, man left.
I am.
Yeah. Okay, good.
No, I didn't leave, no matter what anybody said.
All right. Alan, have a great weekend. Good to talk to you. Judith, Aaron, David, same to you. Have a beautiful weekend, and we'll talk next week. Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.